This is Doris Smith with Siemens PLM Software, and I'm here with Chuck Grindstaff once again. And Chuck, let's catch up on a few things since our last conversation.
Sure.
Let's see, since last time, there's been another acquisition, maybe actually been two in the works, and just wanted to talk a little bit about acquisitions. I think in the last blog post you did with Chris, you kind of get into a little bit about why each of these companies and how we're starting to integrate them. But from a broader perspective, let's just talk about integrating companies and how do you keep an open and innovative culture as your company grows? You know, as you start to merge organizations and cultures, and you know, recently I read an article in Wired that had an interview with Elon Musk of SpaceX, and you know, very innovative company, but a focus on not getting too detailed in the process so that they can, you know, think big. I just wondered how you know, approach that within our company as you try to now integrate all these different cultures.
That's a great question, Dora. The fact of the matter is, I think the real key is listening and learning from the companies that we acquire. Perhaps the simplest way to explain it is, of course, we ourselves, UGS and, you know, now Siemens PLM, were really part of several organizations over the years, you know, part of McDonnell Douglas, part of EDS, an independent company, and then part of Siemens. And in that whole journey through different types of personalities of owners and different sizes of the company, through our developmental stages, we learned a lot. We learned from the larger organizations. We learned from being independent, what it takes to make the right decision quickly, and how to then actualize those decisions and apply our investment dollars properly. During that whole journey, we acquired many companies, and we learned very quickly that if you are really kind of heavy-handed and I wouldn't say maybe demanding is the wrong word, but just sort of deaf to the needs and modes of operation of the companies that kind of come to the overall organization, it can end up generating a lot of wasted value. And so over the years, what we've learned is to listen twice or three or four or five times, and then you know, help those companies sort of pick up the best of what we do, and at the same time, pick up the best that they have to offer. I mean, at the end of the day, software acquisitions are not really about getting code. There's certainly code involved, but it's about the bringing the best and the brightest people with a different perspective on the market together into the team. So over the last year, with the four acquisitions that we did complete, I guess LMS is not quite done. We'll be right after the first year, but the four acquisitions are all focused on sort of technological innovation, filling in areas of design innovation that were really world-renowned and trend-setting, from Vistagy and to Perfect Costing with Kineo and Motion Planning, and that now LMS and systems engineering, simulation and test integration. All those companies, they looked at the market a little bit differently, and they're different sizes. Some of them are quite small, some of them quite large. And as I said, if we apply to the integration of those companies the same sort of insight that we ourselves noticed when we had multiple owners, I think we'll be quite successful. So it's due unto the companies that we buy as we would be done to over the years in our acquisition history, and I think that'll serve us well. We learned with Technomatics, we learned with SCRC and UGS coming together, with all the other smaller acquisitions we did, that this is the best policy.
Now, do you think when you look at the types of people you talked about, the brightest and best people that we're getting from these different organizations, there's, you know, been a lot of studies on what's going on right now in the job market for engineering, manufacturing, and there was a recent one just done by Monster.com looking at, in the U.S., the, you know, a million engineering resumes and the job postings and where there might be gaps. Mm-hmm. So they saw a big growth in industrial engineers over the next few years, computer engineering salaries rising. And so, you know, just a little bit different take of engineering than just the pure mechanical that most of us are used to hearing about in this industry. And so I was just curious where you see things going. Do you think particularly in our own company? I mean, will there be a surge or decline in innovation once we see, more baby boomers retire and maybe these different engineers that are graduating today come to work for us, or these different engineers we've now merged from other organizations?
There's lots of questions in there or issues in there. The simple thing is that engineers, top talent, are in high demand right now. The best and brightest engineers around the world are really in a seller's market. Their companies are looking for the kind of people with not only deep knowledge within their field of expertise, but more importantly, or as importantly, their multidisciplinary appreciation and knowledge. Maybe one difference with some of the older engineers, ones that are certainly retired now or retiring. You think about aerospace engineers that were kind of in the heydays of the 60s and late 50s and early 70s. These are real pioneers that were looking at the entire systems and putting men on the moon the first time. And perhaps if you entered into aeronautical or space engineering now, there's a little bit more tendency to be specialized, and that broad knowledge of looking across systems and understanding how they all interrelate is an important skill that needs to kind of be teased out of the young engineers as they learn deeply and lots of really wonderful, important technological elements within their specific field. It really serves everybody well if from time to time they rotate into adjacencies and look at other systems and how they interrelate. And I think what you're seeing in the job postings and surge in salaries and the like for engineers that are perhaps not the strict specialist is kind of that tendency. The car companies, airplane companies, pretty much anybody who engineers complex products these days is looking for integration opportunities, ways to put things together that haven't been put together in the past. And just look at your cell phone, the kinds of multifunction capabilities that are there. They're being driven with software and high-density electronic integration. These kinds of technological morphings and combinations are happening in cars, are happening in planes, everywhere. So an engineer that understands both the mechanical, the control systems, the electronics, the software side is the kind of person that can drive teams and drive new innovation. So to the point about whether it's faster or slower in today's complex environment, I think it really is speeding up. And if you think where we were in productivity and tools back 20, 30 years ago, we really could accomplish far less in the same period of time with a single engineer than we can today. Tools in the right hands with the right base knowledge can very much accelerate innovation and lead to new insights and thoughts. But it requires a culture in the company that enables exploration, that really does, just reward the adventurous. And sometimes when companies are faced with day in, day out market pressures, it's a little bit hard to let an engineer or engineering group go off and try something that might fail. But I think the best and the brightest companies recognize this and are providing an opportunity for people to explore and frankly, to fail from time to time with some of their ideas and not strictly put them into a very narrow swim lane with predefined processes that used to work in the past and can only be reapplied. I think that's what you were referring to earlier at SpaceX. I think they need to and really do want to allow their engineers to reach out a little bit. And that's a cultural thing, that the tools are there to go faster. And I think, as I said, a lot of companies do recognize that they don't want to constrain the innovation and just work on refinement, but instead want to let their engineers kind of reach out. And there again, those that have the broadest multidisciplinary kind of understanding are the types of engineers that can be most successful in that kind of environment.
How do you think those engineers will adapt to a system like HDPLM? I mean, do you think that does it help address some of this for our customers that we're you know, providing them a little bit more of this information, more maybe organized and integrated already, to improve the process, and giving them this high def look and feel that's a little bit more maybe leads to more innovation. What's your thoughts on how HDPLM plays into this?
Well, remember the HDPLM definition, the pillars of that were really three things. First is integrated intelligent data model and data applications. The idea here is that we're capturing terabytes of information about product relationships, the requirements, the whole network of functional and logical and physical models, and reaching all the way into the physical side, the test and test data, simulation results. There are these terabytes and terabytes of data around a product. It's important to be able to find the right thing, but also to make sure that the connections, the relationships between various artifacts and objects are reliable, so that, you know, it's not simply a big bag of unrelated data, but a set of information that it can be reasoned over with analytics and reports and searching and all the things that are necessary to drive the decision context, the right configuration, the right effectivity. And PLM, you know, certainly our tools are at the forefront of providing that integrated, intelligent data environment. And so that's pillar number one. HDPLM has another element, which is what we call future-proof architecture, and that's really intended more to speak to organizations that depend upon us, that as we extend and improve the architecture, that we do so in a modular and thoughtful fashion, keeping in mind and treating with respect the investment that they have in our products from the past. So we tend to anticipate 3, 4, 10 years out what kinds of technological trends will happen in compute, what kinds of new capabilities we might be able to deliver with additional processing power, with additional operating system and language support. And then we build up our architecture in a modular way so that we can integrate those things quickly. And then the final pillar for HDPLM is a user experience that is engaging, attractive, intuitive, that it's context-oriented. If you take all those three things together, then I think where we feel we've accomplished a foundation for this innovation that we talked about earlier. At the end of the day, means that we can deliver something where people can focus on the problem and not the system. Where, in other words, I don't want our end users to spend all their time learning the intricacies and various ins and outs of our software. I want it to be so intuitive that they can focus almost exclusively on the engineering problem that they're faced with, and the system responds in a expected and predictable fashion to whatever they throw at it. And I think that when we achieve the overall vision for HDPLM, we move the details of the system into the background, and the sophistication underneath this user presentation. I'll give you an example, Dora, with kind of a couple of items at the same time, the future-proof architecture and the user experience. You know, we rolled out last year our active workspace, and you know, it showed a lot of great promise with a search-enabled, built-in analytics, ability to traverse not only graphical 3D data but networks of interrelated objects. And of course, we've had TeamCenter and its user interface, and obviously there's a lot of ideas and impetus to improve and extend that. And what we're able to do is find a way to drive Active Workspace together with the TeamCenter Thin Client, so that Active Workspace 2.0 and the TeamCenter Thin Client based on HTML5 are one and the same. We've got a forward migration path for both of those environments. We provide all of the user excitement that the Active Workspace did, and at the same time deliver it in a consistent fashion to really the broad base of TeamCenter users with the thin client. And so this is the kind of thing I was talking about. We paid attention to the architecture, paid attention to the flow of our customers through time and versioning up and improving the deployment of their systems and take the best and brightest innovations that we come up with and presenting the data and drive that together so that sort of everybody has that same experience and not just those that were kind of lucky enough to sit behind the active workspace.
Now, are there some use cases you're starting to hear back from our customer base where some of that's starting to play out and how they're leveraging those three pillars?
Well, yeah, in fact, I did spend some time with a series of customers over the last few weeks and actually almost a month and a half. And one of the things that came up time and time again is, as we talk to prospects and we look at them potentially switching to our technology, and they measure the amount of time that their end users within their current legacy environments are faced with searching for information, it's really remarkable. In many cases, an engineer or engineer support staff need to log into and out of multiple systems at many large companies. Maybe there's a CAD data management system and a parts system and a warranty system and this and that. And in order to look at maybe an engineering change, you might have to log into the warranty system, collect data there. There might be some analytics, maybe not. Need to then go into the change control system and then from there initiate a change and end up in a PLM environment and then in that PLM environment make a change and then find your way back through the entire pathway. And if you think about how much time an engineer wastes jumping into and out of those systems, how much energy is wasted learning the different semantics and terminology of all these systems, it's pretty clear why somebody would be looking at Siemens and looking at our HD PLM solution to provide for a more consistent single approach to moving through those various phases of the product development cycle. And that's why I say often that we're really not done with this whole space. There's quite a bit to do in improving the fidelity and depth and completeness of the models, but there's also quite to do to make sure that all the processes within our customers are fully comprehended, and that somebody can sit and determine what they want to accomplish, maybe driven by a warranty issue or a reliability issue or an innovation issue, and follow that idea all the way through to fruition with the system being an assistance all the way and not the sort of jumping in and out and running the risk of making a mistake or certainly just slowing you down. So there's quite a bit of value and quite a bit of innovation that is possible still, and I think driven by systems like ours and ours of course in particular, in enabling our customers to work more smartly and in a more integrated way.
So PLM's not finished, not over yet.
No, not by my estimation. I know, some, I guess I was silly enough 30 years ago to think it would only be a decade or so to finish the job. But, as I look forward and we see what's possible now, sometimes I describe it, where I think we're at in PLM is kind of like where the world of biology and biochemistry is when they finally accomplished mapping the genome. It's a great breakthrough. There's lots of really important discoveries and correlations that were known in the past, but really put into context when the human genome was finally mapped. If you look at technology and how that's changed over the last 10 years or so, it's gone from a multi-billion-dollar endeavor to map the human genome to the possibility right now within the next few years of being able to do so on a personal level for $1,000. So the speed and ability of automated lab equipment has really come a long way. The point I'd make, though, is that even though there's that fundamental capability to know how things are put together, there's still a huge amount of science that has yet to be discovered around and developed around that fundamental basic knowledge. Custom drug therapies for maladies that might be related to the genome, certainly specific conditions that might be predicted and avoided or treated. And the same sort of thing is the case in PLM. I think we've largely accomplished over the last few years a pretty good job of mapping the product genome. We know how it goes together. We know what the constituent pieces are. We know all the elements. But we've really just scratched the surface of what one can do when a complete systems model is in place. And the simulations are of really full, realistic, high fidelity, and therefore suitable for testing ideas against that don't really drag you sort of deeply into a cost before an alternative is evaluated, and certainly tied into sort of trial and error. I talked earlier about innovation and exploration, and if we can really enable this full product environment in a accurate and high performance enough fashion, then the engineering kind of leaders of the future will use that to try their ideas out against it a fraction of the cost of what it would have been to try out a similar idea in the past with all physical prototypes and sort of manual techniques to try things out. So I see us in really much to do in this space, really more of exploring and expanding upon that fundamental knowledge we already know about of how a product and its requirements and functions and logic all go together. And the future is quite bright for us. I think there's lots to do. And I think every time we figure something out and provide a new set of tools and techniques, like our fourth generation design technology that lets you slice and dice the design models up in a completely sort of user controlled high performance fashion, applying that through the user presentation layer that I talked about with our high definition UI. I think all these things are going to be tremendous accelerators for innovation. But the fact of the matter is we're not done yet, and we'll keep working at this for many years to come. When you look at our acquisitions, it's pretty clear that that's our strategy, and we'll stick with it, adding technology and teammates who understand technology to expand upon that fundamental product modeling, simulation, management, and manufacturing.
Okay. So just to kind of close up on this kind of innovation topic and where things are headed for the future, I'm doing a junior Lego league this year with my boys and some classmates, and they have to interview people on a little bit older individuals on what has changed most in their life and career, and then eventually build a Lego model that sort of represents that. So they're interviewing a number of folks, but I just thought since I'm talking with someone who's been in the computing industry for a little bit of time,
You're trying to be pretty old, aren't you, Dora?
Yeah. What would you say is there one thing that really sticks out that has changed the most? And what would you say to these young kids as they consider, the whole point of this is trying to get them to consider engineering and computer science?
Well, I think the real thing that's changed through my professional career, coming out of college and into the workplace, is just the ubiquitous integration of computing technology with everything we do. If you look back at cars and infrastructure and factories and just everything around us, the computing technology has driven the lion's share of changes in telecommunications and sort of intelligence within a vehicle, with the integration of sort of systems in aviation. It's a world of computers are at the core of innovation, and software is the way you get computers to do something useful. It's kind of hard to tell a young kid that what life would be like without computing and information technology. But it is the motive factor in innovation, and I think you can look at almost everything around us to see that evidence. So that's a big statement. Transportation. If you look back 35 years, we still had cars, and we had spaceship, rockets that went to the moon, and so So while we've had lots of innovation around those kinds of changes, and cars are better, and you know, people like SpaceX and ULA and all these guys have better rockets these days, the real thing that's different inside those is the computing technology, and it enables completely different approach to almost everything you do. So if your kids are thinking about information technology, I think they've got a bright future.
Good. I will tell them you said so.
Okay.
All right, Chuck. Well, thanks for taking the time today. Anything else that we didn't cover that you wanted to touch on that's happening?
Not this time, Dora. I think just happy to talk to you again, and I think we'll touch base right after the first year then.
Yeah, it sounds good, and we wish you a good happy holidays coming up.
You too.